My Classic Album with Mike Norris is part of Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. For episode archives of My Classic Album and all of the shows on the network, visit us at www.podnose.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at Podnose or send us an email via admin@podnose.com.
Welcome to another edition of My Classic Album, the show where we look back on some of the greatest albums in music history. I'm Mike Norris, and once again, thank you very much for joining me here on My Classic Album for another episode. And thanks to everyone who's been listening via Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. Since we joined Podnose a couple of months ago, we've really been getting a lot of new listeners, which is just really exciting for me. So it's just another avenue for people to listen to the podcast. So if you listened to the last one or you've been listening to previous ones and you enjoyed it, welcome back. I have a feeling that we might have a lot of new listeners this month, and that's simply because of, one, the album that we're going to be talking about today and the man who chose it. So today's classic album is the Rolling Stones' phenomenal Sticky Fingers, and that's been chosen by Dizzy Reed, keyboardist of Guns N' Roses. It's an absolute rush for me to be able to talk to someone from one of my favourite bands of all time about the music that they love. So absolute respect to Dizzy for taking part in the podcast. So that conversation with Dizzy is coming up very soon. I'll not keep you waiting too long for that one. If you want to get involved in the podcast in any way, there's so many ways to do it. Maybe you want to know about upcoming guests and upcoming albums that we'll be covering on the podcast. Maybe you've got an opinion on something we've said. Maybe there's an album we've included that you don't think is a classic album at all. Get yourself onto our Facebook group. Search for My Classic Album with Mike Norris, like the page, and away you go. And that's usually my first port of call when I'm kind of announcing guests or albums that we're going to be covering in the near future. Instagram is also a good shout, at My Classic Album Podcast. And again, just kind of what's coming up on the show. And I'll kind of post a few kind of little bits and bobs as well about stuff that's going on for me and music that I'm listening to at the time, that sort of thing. At @MCA_podcast is our Twitter handle. Regular listeners to the show will know that I really need to get better at Twitter. It's not something that I update a lot, but it's something that I'm going to be working on. But they're the three social media channels for the podcast. And failing all of that, just get yourself to www.myclassicalbum.co.uk for all the latest information about the podcast. And all of our episodes are there, from Sticky Fingers right back to Revolver, which was our first episode. They're all there for you to listen to at your leisure. So we've got some really cool albums coming up over the next few months, as chosen by some really cool guests. I'll not reveal too much just yet. I like to get so far into the kind of the editing process and obviously have the interview out of the way before I start to kind of reveal what these albums are going to be and who's chosen them. But just to give you kind of a couple of clues about some episodes that are coming up. So the majority of the interviews we've done over the past year, I'd say, have been via Skype. So when the podcast started, they were people kind of in my local area, who are the movie touring in the area, and I could get out to see them. Whereas, kind of as it's gone on, and we've kind of branched out and spoke to people all over the world, it's been predominantly on Skype. But one of the episodes that's coming up will be kind of a face-to-face interview, which will be quite cool, because it's been a long time since I've done that. And one of the other episodes, it'll be the first time that we're covering a second album by an artist that we've already touched on My Classic Album. So, for example, in the first 20 episodes that we've done, we've never repeated. There's never been two Beatles albums or two Rolling Stones albums. But someone has chosen an album by an artist that we've already covered, and I'll be talking to them very soon. And I'm sure you'll agree, kind of when I reveal the album and the artist, that kind of fair enough. And that will happen as we cover more classic albums. There'll be certain bands and singers that will get multiple episodes because their back catalogue's just amazing. So that's kind of coming up in the next few months. very cryptic. I don't really want to say much more than that. But we'll see how things go. But I'm sure what you're all here for, what you're all excited for, is to hear my chat with Dizzy Reed from Guns N' Roses about the Rolling Stones' phenomenal album, Sticky Fingers. So Dizzy will be here in just a little bit. But before we speak to Dizzy, let's just look at the facts. Here's the beginning of what you need to know about Sticky Fingers. Released on the 23rd of April 1971, Sticky Fingers is the 9th British or the 11th American studio album by English rock band The Rolling Stones. The band's first album of the 70s, it was also the first release on their new label, Rolling Stones Records. Sticky Fingers was recorded between Olympic and Trident Studios in London, as well as sessions in the Muscle Shoals Sound Studio in Sheffield, Alabama. Jimmy Miller produced the album, the first without founding member Brian Jones, who had passed away 2 years earlier, but the first with guitarist Mick Taylor, who was integral in shaping the sound of the album. Brown Sugar was chosen as the lead single to the album and was released in April 1971. The song became instantly iconic for the band and reached number 2 on the UK singles charts, while reaching the top spot in the US. Brown Sugar has been a regular part of the band's setlist since its inception and was named in Rolling Stone magazine amongst its 500 greatest songs of all time. Fate was similarly kind to second single Wild Horses, performing well in the US and Canada. It too was honoured in the same list by Rolling Stone in 2004. Off the back of 2 huge singles and a lot of momentum for the band, Sticky Fingers reached number 1 across the world in countries such as the UK, US, Canada, Australia, Spain and many more. The album was certified 3 times platinum in the US, with more than 3 million copies sold. Critically, the album is held in high regard and is viewed among the best albums released by the Rolling Stones. Many point to the album as part of a classic period for the band, which also includes albums including Let It Bleed and Exile on Main Street. In Colin Larkin's 1994 book All Time Top 1000 Albums, Sticky Fingers was voted into 10th place, while Rolling Stone magazine placed Sticky Fingers number 63 in its 500 Greatest Albums of All Time list in 2003. So that's just the beginning of what we need to know about Sticky Fingers. And I have here with me today my special guest who chose the album. This is Dizzy Reed. How's it going?
It's going good, thank you.
Awesome, awesome. So before we kind of get in to the album itself, why is it that you've chosen Sticky Fingers to talk about on my classic album today?
I guess a couple reasons. I think the Stones, Rolling Stones, are, if I had to pick one like favorite band or I guess band that was the biggest influence on me, I would go with the Rolling Stones. And especially because they've been around for so long and they have such a huge catalog and they've, you know, done so many great things. But I especially really got into, when I was younger, the Mick Taylor sort of era, I like to call it, the albums that he did with the Stones, not specifically because of him, but he had a big part of that. But I think that's when they were sort of gelling as a band. And I think Sticky Fingers, if I had to pick one record, and it's a tough choice, from that era, I would Sticky Fingers, I think, because I think it's sort of, yeah, it started a lot of things for them. It's sort of, they were sort of reborn, I think, at that point. It's like a second life. So yeah, there's a lot of reasons, but that's where it starts.
Yeah. What are those initial memories for you of hearing that album for the first time? What was that like?
Well, when I first started listening to music, I would buy singles, 45s. And I heard Brown Sugar on the radio, and I already had a band. I think I was probably 12 years old, maybe 11, 12. And so I was like, you know, discovering new songs that I wanted to play with my band. And I heard Brown Sugar, and I went out and bought the single, and I thought, this is, I'd never heard anything like it. It was magic. And you know, it was taking on Americana. It was a British band. I knew that. But that's when I really started, I got very intrigued by the band. But I listened to the B-side, which I think was Bitch, and I went, I got to get the record. That's 2 songs, so what's the rest of it like? And it wasn't really what I expected, but it was something more. It was just the whole, it's incredible.
Yeah. And is it kind of, maybe, is it Brown Sugar particularly that makes it stand out compared to albums like, you know, Let It Bleed or Exile on Main Street? Is it Brown Sugar particularly, or is it just the whole package?
Well, just to clarify, you know, I could have easily picked either one of those records.
Yeah. Yeah.
I thought maybe Exile might have been too much to talk to you, but, and you know, they kind of lead into the other, you know, there, I think there was a couple leftover tracks from Let It Bleed. that made it onto Sticky Fingers, at least maybe Sister Morphine, I think, possibly, was done in the Let It Bleed sessions, possibly. Don't quote me on that, though. And then it kind of sets up Exile, really, it does. But Brown Sugar in particular, just it gets your attention. It's one of the greatest guitar riffs of all time, I think. And ironically, I think it was actually written by Mick Jagger, if I'm not mistaken, which is kind of interesting.
So the 2 years between Let It Bleed and Sticky Fingers were very eventful, not only for the band, but the world in general. So we went through this kind of loss of innocence at the end of the 60s with the Manson family murders. And in December, during the Rolling Stones concert at Altamont Speedway in California, there was a fan who was stabbed to death just feet from the stage. Do you think that these events, and particularly Altamont, of course, and the end of the 60s, do you think that influences the sound that we hear on Sticky Fingers?
I think one thing leads into another for sure. But I think most importantly, they had taken on the social change, you know, Sympathy for the Devil, Street Fighting Man, the songs like that were, they weren't hiding. They weren't writing pop schlock. They were writing really cool songs that were taking on the subject of Mother's Little Helper is another one. So I think they'd done their part. I think what they were sort of like, they were the bad boys of rock. They're always going to be that. But they took on Americana at that point. I think in some ways, possibly they were putting that behind them, but they were still, they weren't talking about, it's all happy, happy stuff. Brown Sugar obviously takes on one of the darkest subjects in American history. And it was a hit and people were buying it. People were listening to it. So, they're making, I don't know if people were more aware of things at that point or maybe, I don't know. But, Sister Morphine, that's a hardcore drug addiction song. So, I think it's just all kinds of, kind of leads into the next thing, really.
Yeah. Professor Eddie Ashworth, who is a professor at Ohio University School of Media Arts and Studies, he believes that Sticky Fingers marked a real turning point in the Rolling Stones' career. He says that the Rolling Stones had always been in the shadow of the Beatles, whether or not they'd ever admit it. Although they were their own thing, you could easily see them emulating the Beatles throughout their career, but it's during Sticky Fingers that the Rolling Stones really came into their own. Everything we think of as defining the latter-day Rolling Stones came to fruition in this post-Beatles period. Now that the Beatles have disbanded by the point we're talking about, is this the first time that we kind of hear the Rolling Stones be the Rolling Stones? Would you agree with what he's saying there?
For the first time ever, I'm going to agree with the professor when he's talking about... Yes, I agree.
Yeah. So earlier in the year, original Stones guitarist Brian Jones sadly died, which makes Sticky Fingers the first album with Mick Jones as a fully fledged member of the band. Of course, he had kind of appeared on bits of the previous album. What does Mick bring to the Rolling Stones? And I know you've talked about kind of how much you enjoy that era. What does he bring to the band that perhaps wasn't there before or since?
Well, Mick Taylor, he brings in a second Mick, obviously. Mm-hmm. some bands got to take that on. They have the same name, It's like, we had a Dizzy and an Izzy. It wasn't quite the same, but they had two
nearly
Micks. But I think just his style, the stuff that he plays on Moonlight Mile, on Sway, I think he possibly, these are just, rumors we heard when we were kids and stuff. I think he possibly wrote Sway or helped write that song, which is an amazing song. He's playing on that too. He brings in that sort of that missing link to truly good sort of blues rock playing that they quite didn't have. On Sympathy for the Devil, that's not Keith playing the solo. And Keith's amazing, obviously, but just let him be himself. Let him be Keith and do his thing, play with five strings or whatever he was doing on stage for whatever reason. I think Mick Taylor's style. I remember seeing pictures of him. At one point he had this huge afro fro thing going on. I was like, that guy is cool. I want to be like, dude. But eventually I stuck with Keith. I wanted to be like Keith, but I couldn't because I can't play guitar. So.
So I know, again, kind of related to you, Slash told Guitar World magazine a few years back that Mick Taylor had the biggest influence on me without even knowing it. Do you think that Mick is perhaps underrated compared to the likes of Keith Richards and Ronnie Wood?
1,000%, yes. And I think he was underrated. And, in some ways it's weird to compare Mick Taylor and Keith Richards, I think. But and that sounds weird, but it's true. I think he was definitely underrated. I think overshadowed, and I think they kind of made it that way at some point. I think, especially upon his departure, you know, you don't hear too much about him after that. And Ron Wood's a larger than life character that came in later. So a lot of people maybe just kind of forgot about Mick Taylor. For sure, probably I would say he's underrated, overshadowed, and possibly just not given enough credit.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Mick Jagger had the following to say about Mick Taylor to Rolling Stone back in 1995. He said he was a very fluent, melodic player, which we never had, and we don't have now. Neither Keith nor Ronnie plays that kind of style. I could sit down with Mick Taylor and he could play very fluid lines against my vocals. He was exciting and he was very pretty, and it gave me something to follow, to bang off. Some people think that's the best version of the band that existed. I mean, that's a huge compliment to be compared so favorably to two legendary guitarists who were in that band.
No, absolutely. That's, you know, hey, if the singer's comfortable, then it's working. That's how that goes.
Absolutely. So studio sessions for Sticky Fingers began in 1970 while the band were embroiled in a messy legal battle with Decca Records. And that's one of the major reasons for the decision to release the album on their own label, Rolling Stones Records. Is there a sense of more creative freedom on this album? The idea that they could do what they want because it's been released on their own label?
Absolutely. When you don't have that presence lurking over you, whether you stand up to them or not, it's when it's gone, it opens a lot of doors. You don't have to deal with that. You're going to be able to do what you want. And I think at that point, they didn't need any direction. I think they knew where they were going. They knew what they were doing, and they probably couldn't have done it without that. And you also, you know, you get that logo. You see that logo for the first time, the tongue and the lips. That's part of the whole thing. That's part of the new era, the rebirth, like as I like to call it, that goes along with that. And that's, you know, that was that's one of the first sort of like I don't know what the word is. It's a brand. It's a thing. You had the logo of the band possibly, but you didn't really see that as much. That's one of the most identifiable things of all time, really, when it comes to that type of thing.
Absolutely. And I mean, our friend Professor Eddie Ashworth.
Eddie.
He said about the logo, he said they started to create the iconography that we know now. The mouth with the tongue sticking out dates back to this era. The sort of mainstream debauchery side of the band started to be emphasized more, rather than the actual dangerous side of the band's early days. This trade-off of this era of the Stones is that they became more of a brand. And I guess that's essentially what you've said. Is that the start of them becoming like this more mainstream version of the band?
I think I got to sit down with this guy and have a couple beers and talk. I think we got a lot to say.
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, and let's not forget about the album cover. I mean, there was the original one had the zipper on it, you know. I mean, that was, you know, that there was a bit of intrigue about that too. You know, it's like what's going on there? And I was a kid, so it's like I know there was adult themes all over that, you know. And I didn't really know who Andy Warhol was at the time, but I know that he put that together. Mm-hmm. But you can't forget that. And this part of the whole brand, it's part of the bad boy thing. It's part of the sex, drugs, and rock and roll thing that was starting at that point in time, you know. So, the professor's got a lot of cool things to say about it, man. I should have, he's awesome.
And like I say, I mean, we've been talking about the album cover. I mean, as you said, there's this great story behind it, almost a mystery behind it. No one really knows which model was used for that final shot. Several people claim it was them or believe it was them. And again, the real zipper that you were talking about, that initially there was a real zipper on the cover that when pulled down revealed the model's underwear. And I guess it's so easy to forget not only how controversial that would have been, but very innovative as well at the same time.
I just want to say one thing. I'm glad the model was wearing underwear, because I would not have wanted to unzip that thing if he was
absolutely,
who knows,
agreed,
lurking in his album cover.
Is it the best Rolling Stones album cover for you?
I don't know about that. I think they have a lot of cool ones. Some Girls is probably the best one. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Do you remember that one?
Yeah, absolutely. So now seems a good time as any just to go track by track. So we'll start with Brown Sugar, of course. First track on the album, credited to both Mick Jagger and Keith Richards. It opens the album. Clash Music calls the song a supercharged romp, alluding to heroin, slave rape, interracial and underage sex. While Mick Jagger once said it covers all the nasty subjects in one go. Before we get too into that lyrical content, what has made that such an iconic song for the Rolling Stones? And indeed, it sounds like yourself as well.
It's got all the perfect elements. It's got the killer. It, first of all, the opening riff, the guitar riff, that's, like I said earlier, that's one of the greatest guitar riffs of all time. It's it catches your attention. It's danceable. All right. It's got the harmonies. It's got the woos. When you throw woos in a song, that's, you know, big plus. And it's got Bobby Keys on saxophone. A lot of times, you know, sax can either work great or it can just ruin the vibe of a song. And Bobby Keys always makes it great.
Yeah. And we'll touch on Bobby Keys later because I think he's such an important part of the album throughout. I mean, Brown Sugar is one of three songs off the album recorded at Muscle Shoals Sound Studio in Alabama, along with Wild Horses and You Gotta Move. So Keith Richards said in the documentary, Muscle Shoals, that the 3 days at the studio were one of the easiest and rockingest sessions we'd ever done. I don't think we've ever been quite so prolific ever. Those sessions were as vital to me as any I've ever done. I mean, all the other stuff we did, Beggar's Banquet, Gimme Shelter, Street Fighting Man, I've always wondered that if we had cut them at Muscle Shoals, if they might have been a little different, a little bit funkier. Is there something to what Keith's saying there? Is there kind of a funkier sound to those songs?
Well, I think, so they probably had some really good drugs there. no, I'm just kidding. Sorry, Keith. The environment is a huge part of what goes on in recording sessions. So if you go into a place like Muscle Shoals or any place that's historic, like Olympic in London, or you know, maybe even the Record Plant here in LA or a place like that, and you know, all these things that have great things that have happened there, and the environment and the people that are working there, especially, and you know, the way it's set up, and it's, you know, some recording studios are put someplace for a reason. To, you know, it might be the neighborhood, it might be the history, whatever. All these things come together to make a good environment. And when that fits with the band, there's no question that it definitely opens up things that, you know, creative portals that need to happen to make the record what it is and to make that magic happen. Sometimes it doesn't work at all. You can put a band in the wrong place at the wrong time. And I think in this case, it was the right place to be. And yeah, you know, if you can get the tones you want and whatever you need to make that happen and it comes together, there's nothing like that experience.
So while the point of a podcast like this is usually try and get into the meaning of a song, in some ways Brown Sugar's not really the song to do that. Mick Jagger told Rolling Stone that there's so many taboo subjects in the song while keeping it ambiguous. That makes it the whole mess thrown in. God knows what I'm on about on that song. It's such a mishmash. All the nasty subjects in one go. I never would write that song now.
No, it wouldn't work now. Not at all. It's, you know, we our culture is completely different now. It's completely changed. So I think whereas back then he was taking on subjects that were taboo. Now they're not taboo. They're just not correct. You know. So if you're going to talk about that, you know, you probably a lot of that stuff, especially the slavery issue, whatnot, you know, you don't talk about it like that. So I think, yeah, he probably wouldn't write that song today or maybe even 10 years ago. Yeah. But back then, it worked for whatever reason.
So Loretta Charlton at Vulture.com claims the song was originally titled Black Pussy. And Jagger, during a rare moment of clear-headedness in 69, decided that was too nitty-gritty and nixed it. Everything else, the misogyny, the racism, the sexism, the reference to drugs, and cunnilingus would stay. Since then, it's been called one of the nastiest, most controversial and racist songs of all time, but in her opinion. Is it fair to call the song racist, and does that make it harder to listen to in a modern context?
I don't think it is. I don't think that was the goal of the song. I don't think that's what was implied. I don't think it is. Yeah. That's my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah. So we'll move on to our next track, which is Sway. So Sway is a really good example of Mick Taylor's influence on Sticky Fingers. Keith Richards was essentially MIA for a lot of the Sticky Fingers sessions, and this left the two Micks to bounce off each other, which we were kind of talking a bit about earlier. How does a track like Sway differ from songs earlier in the band's career, perhaps before Mick Taylor joined the band?
You know, Mick Taylor, that's you know, he's playing a certain style that's setting the foundation for that song that you haven't really heard yet. God, it's just those melodies, they're so sing along. They're beautiful, really. And it's something that just, you walk away. You can sing that in the morning when you're having coffee, you can sing it at the pub at night. It's incredible. And obviously the Stones had sing-along hits for years, but that just strikes a certain nerve. And I don't know. I don't think they've ever done anything like that since then either.
So Clash Music believed that Sway marked the conclusive end of the psychedelic Stones. So when Brian Jones died, so too did that experimentation with dulcimers, sitars and marimbas. Mick Taylor brought to the band a melodic fluidity. His virtuosity offering new musical possibilities for the group. Is this an example of the band kind of facing their future and embracing that brand we were talking about that would become the Rolling Stones?
I think it's part of the equation for sure. Definitely. You know, it's, but it's, you know, it's, and it's just great that it's track number two. It's just, cause it just, Brown Sugar and then boom, he sets it up right there. It's incredible.
A great conversation I'm having with Dizzy Reed about Sticky Fingers by the Rolling Stones. And we're just getting started. Coming up, which songs on the album were the first songs that Dizzy ever learned to play on guitar? And why exactly does he normally not trust professors? All that and more, right after this.
They'd never done anything like this album before, ever. There was such a mix of stuff on it.
Would you like to get involved with the discussion on My Classic Album? Or maybe you'd like to be a guest on a future episode?
I don't think there's any other album that is so poignant and so human in its lyrics.
Like us on Facebook by searching for My Classic Album with Mike Norris. Alternatively, you could follow us on Instagram at My Classic Album Podcast, or even tweet us over at MCA_podcast.
This music is inside of me, and I couldn't not be influenced by it if I tried.
But at the time, it blew my mind, and it blew millions of people's mind, and that's why it's my classic record.
Make sure you never miss an episode and keep up to date with all the latest news at www.myclassicalbum.co.uk.
Why is whatever people say I am, that's what I'm not, your classic album? And why should people check it out?
It was amazing, that's why.
So our next track is Wild Horses. Another iconic song, and one that Rolling Stone magazine ranked in its 500 greatest songs of all time. It was recorded in the same sessions as Brown Sugar, but in some ways it couldn't be any different. Mick Jagger said of the song, "I remember we sat around originally doing this with Graham Parsons, and I think his version came out slightly before ours. Everyone always says this was written about Marianne, but I don't think it was. That was all well over by then. I was definitely very inside this piece emotionally." Is this the Rolling Stones at their most tender and raw, or are there other tracks that would kind of jump ahead of it?
I think Wild Horses is another way that they were tapping into Americana. It's, you know, it was a Graham Parsons song. I love Graham Parsons' version, but to me, it's not even the same song. It's Wild Horses. They take it to a dark place.
Yeah.
And it's as beautiful as it is. It's not happy. It's amazing what they did with it. So, but again, because it was a Graham Parsons song, they're tapping into that energy and they're putting it out there. They're doing it way it's like, you know, that would really show up on Exile on Main Street, that whole thing. Just, you know, the American Southwest. And I mean, there's a whole thing happening out this way at that time, you know, with the Flying Burrito Brothers and eventually the Eagles and Linda Ronstadt and Warren Zevon, all that. And that's, you know, that's their way into that.
Yeah. So, I mean, while there's been speculation that Jagger's inspiration for the song was his dying relationship with Marianne Faithfull, Keith Richards appears to have been inspired by missing his newborn son and struggling with life on the road away from him. And we talk a lot on My Classic Album with all these kind of songs, this theme of being away from home and life on the road coming up a lot. Is that something you've struggled with in your own career? Is that a difficult thing to kind of to handle?
It's not easy. I mean, it's all you want to do when you're younger, and then you start doing it and you go, wait a second. It's because you as much fun as you want to have and how great it is, it's eventually you start realizing that what you're doing it's not for everybody and it's not normal. And especially if you have a family or a home life of any kind, it can get to you. And it's definitely a good source of inspiration for songwriting and all that. But it's just kind of hard to make people feel sorry for you when you know out there playing in front of thousands of people and whatnot. It's always going to be there. I think we're always going to write about that experience because that's what we become. That's what we are.
Yeah. So, I mean, you've talked a bit about the Flying Burrito Brothers and kind of this Graham Parsons kind of rendition of it. Slate.com said, while the pristine guitars and honky-tonk piano of Wild Horses are straight country, the vocal is blues through and through. Compare Jagger's performance with Graham Parsons, released a year before the Stones' own, and the difference is remarkable. Parson's pretty careful vocal glides on top of the beat, while Jagger's is ragged and laconic, the song's famous chorus sounding less like celebration than tired and pained. And that's what you were saying, how dark this interpretation of it is.
Yeah, Wild Horses, it's a whole different image. It really is. You know, Gram Parsons, you're running free in the desert and it's all beautiful. And Mick, it's like, now you're saying goodbye to something, or you know, going someplace you don't necessarily want to, but you have to, I think.
So the song's been covered by so many people over the years. I think I've seen maybe a rendition or two, including yourselves on stage with Guns N' Roses. What makes this song so enduring over the years for everybody?
Like a lot of songs on Sticky Fingers, it's very accessible. In other words, you can pick up an acoustic and go, oh, here's what they're playing, and you can sing it. All right. Simplicity is what really makes it so effing cool. And I say simplicity, but you know, that's on the surface. There's a lot of nuances and a lot of great things that go into a great song that, you know, people don't pick up on or can't emulate. But the basic elements of the song are very accessible.
Cool. So our next track is Can't You Hear Me Knockin', which is one of my favorite songs on the album. Another one with Mick Taylor all over it. And it's perhaps most famous for this extended instrumental break nearly 3 minutes in with a jam that has an almost kind of Carlos Santana vibe to it. Do you kind of hear that almost Latin kind of sound that dominates? What's it like for you?
I think I've always seen it as more tribal than Latin, I think. Okay. But yeah. The elements are there to make it, qualify as probably Latin. I think, you know, I play percussion and a lot of the, if I can't think of something, I just listen to the end of that song and then I got a beat. So that works.
Yeah.
But Billy Preston's playing organ on that song too. You can't forget that. That's really effing cool. Who's playing piano on that? It's like, Nicky Hopkins possibly.
I think, so, yeah, possibly. Yeah.
But yeah, it's just one. It's a great album track. You know, it's got the really cool riff and it's just very, mysterious. I think it's another, they really started to touch on some elements that they would embrace later. I think there's a little bit of that Caribbean sort of thing going on there, which they, you know, eventually they're on Black and Blue and stuff. There's a lot of that.
Yeah.
But it's just a cool jam at the end. You know, it just makes you want to play, man.
It's interesting that you would kind of dismiss the Latin thing, because I think Keith Richards did something similar in 2002. He said the jam at the end wasn't inspired by Santana. We didn't even know they were still taping. We thought we'd finished. We were just rambling and they kept the tape rolling. I figured we'd just fade it off. It was only when we heard the playback that we realised, oh, they kept it going. Basically, they realised we had two bits of music. There's the song and then there's the jam. And I think that's what I love about the song so much.
And, you know, I say that out of respect to great Latin music, which, yeah, I'm a big fan of. That's why. And I think a lot of people are just easy to categorize things by going, oh, I hear a shaker and a gyro and a bock and, oh, it's Latin. It's not. Out of fairness to people who play good Latin music or great Latin music, especially like Santana, it was Latin influenced music. That's all.
Yeah. So we'll move on to You Gotta Move. So You Gotta Move started life as an African American spiritual song, which was recorded by Hill Country blues singer Fred McDowell. And it was Fred's version that inspired the Sticky Fingers version. How important is the kind of the blues to the sound of the Rolling Stones for kind of the uninitiated who maybe only have kind of heard the hits?
This is what I think. You know, obviously Keith and Mick were like a lot of, young, up and coming English rock musicians, wannabe rock musicians at the time when that's what they were listening to. They're listening to the blues. They got turned on to Chuck Berry and all that. And then they went back to see what influenced him and what, you know, that basically just opened doors. And so I think it's important because in that way, by doing those songs that they do, and they do a few over the years, they're paying tribute to what influenced them, but they're also turning on new people and younger generations to that music. And I always say, it's like, if you like a band, you know, figure out who they listen to and then listen to that and then figure out who they listen to and go back, you know, and you're always going to make your way back to the blues records that were out back in the early part of the last century. And that's what they're doing there. Yeah.
So, I mean, at this point, if you think back to the whole of side one, particularly our last three tracks, Sticky Fingers is a deceptively eclectic album. Do you think that it might be the most varied album of their career, or would they experiment more throughout the 70s?
Well, again, it's very classic, but this is their, like we talked about earlier, it's the first album they did without the label hanging over them, you know? So I think they were just getting started with sort of the experimentation and whatnot. I mean, Exile on Main Street, which is the one coming after that, that's an adventure, that whole record. It's just they're doing kind of whatever they really want to do, and it works. So I think, you know, and sometimes it's not easy to get everything you want into 10 songs. It's not. But they did a good job. So, yeah, it's tough not to include Sticky Fingers when you're talking about classic records of the 70s or of all time. It's got to be in there.
Yeah. So we'll move on to Bitch, our next track. Caesar returned to a more familiar side of the band. And while a song like Can't You Hear Me Knockin' is all about Mick Taylor, Bitch to me kind of screams Keith Richards. Engineer Andy Johns recalls, when we were doing Bitch, Keith was very late. Jagger and Mick Taylor had been playing the song without him, and it didn't sound very good. I walked out the kitchen and he was sitting on the floor with no shoes, eating a bowl of cereal. Suddenly he said, "Oi Andy, give me that guitar." I handed him his clear Dan Armstrong plexiglass guitar. He put it on, kicked the song up in tempo, and just put the vibe right on it. Instantly, it went from being this mess into a real groove. And I thought, wow, that's what he does.
Yes, that is what Keith does. That's what any great guitarist does, really. They can take any sort of riff and turn it upside down or put that stank on it, whatever it needs to make it what it needs to be. And I've had the great pleasure of working with Andy Johns in the past, and I'm sure he probably had a little bit of something to do with the sound of that song, too.
So how do the very different styles of two guitarists like Keith Richards and Mick Taylor complement each other throughout this album, and indeed on a track like Bitch?
Anytime you have that duality and it's accepted and you can take that energy and you work it off of each other, that's what makes good bands great. That's what makes good records great. So it's not easy to do sometimes, you know, because we have our egos and stuff. But clearly, I'm sure, you know, Keith was in charge of the situation. So if he embraced it, then it's going to work. It's going to make, you know, the rest of the band too. Yeah. If they can work with it, it's just going to make things great. That's how you get to the next level. That's how you take things to, you know, that level. Yeah.
So, I mean, we talked a bit about Bobby Keys earlier, and Bitch is another really cool example of the brass on this album. You know, Bobby Keys on saxophone, Jim Price on trumpet. They've played on so many Rolling Stones albums. In some ways, they're almost kind of like honorary members themselves. How important is that heavy brass to the overall sound of the Rolling Stones? And is it something that they replicate in their live shows?
It's a huge part of it. It goes back to that early sound, you know, Chuck Berry and stuff with the saxophone. And so I think it's like, that's always something that they're hearing and that needs to be there. It's not an easy thing to put, it doesn't belong everywhere. So it has to be right. And they always get it right. Bobby Keys and the Stones always get it right. You know, another thing about the song Bitch, I remember reading when I was a kid, there was some medical report that said because it skips a beat, sort of, it's got the offbeat thing.
Hmm.
That it would cause heart palpitations.
Ah.
And that's why I don't ever listen to what professors have to say about rock and roll music. That's all changed as of today.
All right, yeah. So we'll get on to I Got the Blues. It's another track with Bobby and Jim on it, and it seems to take inspiration from the likes of Otis Redden. And the Rolling Stones, of course, covered Otis Redden's I've Been Loving You Too Long in 1965, a song which some cite as an inspiration for this song. So is Otis Redden kind of an important part of kind of the makeup of the sound of the Rolling Stones?
Yeah, I Got the Blues, I think, is like, again, it's another element of them sort of really reaching into and identifying with and grabbing onto Americana, right? So this I Got the Blues, it's Memphis, man. That's you know, that's what they're doing there. And they do it quite well. But it's just that Memphis sound. It's like, it's, you know, stacks, it's all that. They nail it.
Yeah. So in a review of the track, allmusic.com say the instrumental highlight is supplied by guest organist Billy Preston, who lets loose with a real keening peal at one point. Now, Billy worked with so many great musicians, including the Beatles, Eric Clapton and Sam Cooke, but he appeared on many Rolling Stones albums and tours. Do you think the presence of all these ridiculously talented session musicians on albums like Sticky Fingers, it's surely only going to like enhance it? And it's perhaps an underrated aspect of a classic album.
Yeah, Billy Preston's so cool. I'll never be that cool. But yeah, I mean, that organ solo in the middle of that song is like, it's, you know, when I heard that, I'm like, I have to learn how to play that. And which back then is not an easy thing because you got that record and you're putting the needle back over and over and over until you can figure it out. Now you just put it on your computer and you loop it and you slow it down and go, oh, there it is. I got it. Wasn't that easy back then. So, you know, and to be up here, and then you could do it here.
So we'll move on to Sister Morphine. So this is another one of my favourites on the album. It was written with and originally recorded by Marianne Faithfull. Her version was actually withdrawn in the UK due to the drug reference in the title, and the Stones released it on this album, a version that Clash Music calls a bleak and diabolical cry for help. Is this the darkest song in their back catalogue?
By far. It's so dark, it's just like, I almost got sick the first time I really listened to it. So I was going through withdrawals, you know. It's certainly, it made me not want to do drugs ever. Mm-hmm. But that changed later. But anyway, it's something about that song. It's the first song I learned how to play on an acoustic guitar because I could. That and then the next, you know, then Dead Flowers. Those are the first two songs I learned how to play on a guitar. And so I really didn't understand what it was about when I was a kid. I had no idea. And so my band, we used to play it. And, you know, people would be out there slow dancing to it. No idea. We're all kids in junior high. So be careful, folks, when you put music out there. You never know. But, yeah, it's by far the darkest song maybe that they ever recorded, possibly.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, Rolling Stone magazine named it in its 10 best Rolling Stones deep cuts. What are your thoughts on the track kind of compared to kind of their back catalogue? And has it proved a popular deep cut over the years amongst Rolling Stones fans?
I don't know if everybody likes it. I've never really, it's doesn't really come up a lot, but it's definitely a deep cut. That song is never going to get played on the radio.
No.
Right. But so you have to know the Stones to really get, know it and appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, the Stones version kept a similar arrangement to Marianne's recording, but with more like assertive, fuller textures and a bluesier finish, according to AllMusic. It's a really dark song lyrically, which is captured perfectly in the music. And do you think that Keith Richards and indeed the band's experience with drugs in particular had to be kind of a big part of the lyrical aspects of the song, that they were able to kind of bring that experience, and that's why it's so dark and so real?
Man, if that isn't the case, then they're fooling a lot of people. So, they nail it. They nail it for sure. And I think probably, yeah, it's sort of a gonzo, self-immersion, if you will.
Yeah. And again, just before we move on to the next track, another fantastic musician, Ry Cooder, on slide guitar on this track, which is just, oh.
It's haunting. It's creepy. It's scary. It's when the drums kick in, it's like, you know, I didn't know what the hell he was doing. It kind of scared me a little bit. I knew it wasn't Keith, though, you know. And so then I didn't quite understand who Ry Cooder was at the time, but eventually I did. And it's another one of those things that you just, it takes that song to that place it needed to go. And somebody was hearing it and someone knew that that was the right guy to come in and do that. And they nailed it again.
So just when you think you've got the album all figured out, along comes Dead Flowers with this real kind of country sound to it, which seems to have been inspired by Keith Richards' friendship with Gram Parsons. Did the band kind of continue this country influence? You were saying that Sticky Fingers is like the start of the Rolling Stones doing what they want. Does that kind of country influence continue onto future albums?
It does. There's a few. Well, I mean, I think it started earlier, though, with Country Honk, the Honky Tonk Woman country version. You know, that's when they first sort of, I think, really started getting into that. But Far Away Eyes, I mean, that could be a classic country song in any realm, really, you know. And that's later on. That's on, what's that on? Some Girls, I think, maybe.
Some Girls.
But Dead Flowers is just an all around classic, I think. And again, it's one of the first songs I learned how to play on guitar, so I still play it. You know, if I need Philip Tynan, well, let's do Dead Flowers, you know. And then we do, I won't get into that. Anyway, but and again, it's them sort of touching on Americana again. I keep saying that, but that's really has a lot to do with what they're doing here. And it worked in a way that no other bands have been able to do it. And the other bands have tried, you know, I mean, English bands especially, but a lot of American bands can do it really either, but they did it perfectly.
I mean, Jagger talked about the kind of the country influence on this song back in 2003. He said the country songs we recorded later, like Dead Flowers or Far Away Eyes, are slightly different than our earlier ones. The actual music is played completely straight, but it's me who's not going legit with the whole thing because I think I'm a blues singer, not a country singer. I think it's more suited to Keith's voice than mine. So do you get that sense when you hear these songs like Far Away Eyes or Dead Flowers, that Mick's perhaps not fully committed to the bit. Maybe he's having a bit of fun with the vocal as opposed to the kind of the music being played straight.
I think he's got a point there. He's more suited for Keith's voice. However, wouldn't be the same without Mick singing it. And it's funny because he overdoes the country drawl. You know what I mean? It's like he's going out of his way to sound that way in a way that is almost comical, or it's satirical, I guess. Mm-hmm. But it's Mick, so who cares? It works.
Yeah. So we've got to our final track, which is Moonlight Mile. So it was written after an all-night session from the two Micks. Slate magazine calls the song the strangest and most unique recording in the Rolling Stones' entire back catalogue. What makes Moonlight Mile so special?
First of all, Mick Taylor's playing on it is unbelievable. Paul Buckmaster's string arrangement, that's there. I mean, with that, that's really... And it's kind of this, it's the last track on the record, so it leaves you like, just kind of sort of pondering and maybe possibly breathless, and I'm not sure, but ready for more, for sure. But I think it's like the finale to them ushering in this new era again. But yeah, Paul Buckmaster, who just passed away recently, and I had the honor and the pleasure to work with, it's one of the great rock and roll string arranger of all time, probably. He did so many great records during that era, and he appears on this, and it's that's one of the things that makes it really great. This is the best end of the night drunken reflective song you could probably ever put on.
Yeah, and I guess that's what I got here. It has this almost kind of dreamy up all night feel to it. Mick Jagger told the Wall Street Journal, "What makes Moonlight Mile so special is that it's a song and a recording at once. All these things, the strange plinking piano, the Tommy mallets on the drums, the different guitars, they all came together to produce a feeling of vulnerability and loneliness. I think the three of us finished recording the basic track around 6. The sun was coming up." And as I say, it's got that kind of dreamy feel to it. Like you said, it's the perfect song just to have on kind of at the end of a night when you've been up and kind of putting the world to rights.
They did something that it's not easy to do. They captured a moment. They really did. You can do that in film, video, whatever, but to do that in a song and really capture a moment like that, or at least make people think you're, capturing a moment, they pulled it off. It's very genuine, you can tell.
Yeah. So after all the kind of the eclectic jumps from all the kind of from blues to country and everything in between, how does a track like Moonlight Mile end the album for you?
It leaves me sort of satisfied, but definitely wanting more.
Mm. And I guess that's what all classic albums should do, really, with their last track. And I guess that works really well. It's an album full of hits, yet rich in deep cuts and hidden gems. Yet among the fantastic musicianship, there are many who say that Sticky Fingers, from a songwriting perspective, is Mick Jagger's finest hour. Why has Sticky Fingers stood the test of time for you?
It's just that's what great things do. Great things will. It's embedded in me. It's part of my makeup. It's a record I listen to over and over. It's a record I try to emulate constantly, and still I still refer to it all the time, because it's a great piece of work, man. It's great songwriting, great recording. Everything's there. All the elements are there. It's something that, it's now years later, I listen to it to refresh my memory and to help sort of teach me what I, reinstill those things into my brain that I need to do when I'm recording or when I'm writing or when I'm performing. And that's what great records do for a guy like me.
And finally, why is Sticky Fingers your classic album? And why should people check it out if they've been living under a rock and they haven't checked it out already?
For all the reasons we talked about here today, folks, you know what? If you like good songs, if you like to go on an adventure sonically and lyrically, if you want to transport yourself to another really cool place and time before a lot of bad things and right after a lot of bad things, this is the record for you. Check it out.
Awesome. Well, Dizzy, thank you very much for joining me. It's been an absolute pleasure. Before I kind of let you go, I just want to talk a bit about your album, Rock and Roll Ain't Easy. I listened to it and I thought it was absolutely awesome. And I was just kind of wondering kind of what your plans are this year. I know you've got some dates with Guns N' Roses, and I obviously know that you'll be kind of on your own tour kind of promoting the album.
Well, eventually we will tour when time permits. You know, Guns N' Roses is my number one priority at the time, but we are going to tour, and we're going to, you know, we're going to do a release at some point this summer when I'm over there with Guns, and you know, I'll be try to work things in and around our my days off and try to get out there and make them not days off and come on and say hi and get, you know, make people aware of the record, and they should check it out, man. It's a labor of love. It took a long time, and Sticky Fingers was definitely a big influence on how we made this record, for sure.
Awesome. And I know, obviously, Guns N' Roses headlining Download Festival on the Saturday night. If anyone who hasn't seen you guys since Slash and Duff returned, what can they expect from the show?
An amazing rock and roll show. It's been a lot of fun, and we're going to have a lot more fun this summer. The fans are fantastic. So it's something, you know, if you can come out, you don't want to miss it. Don't be that guy. Don't be the guy that, you know, has to hear about it. Be that guy that's talking about it.
But no, thank you very much. It's been awesome.
Awesome, man. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Huge thanks to Dizzy Reed for joining My Classic Album to pick a truly classic album, Sticky Fingers by the Rolling Stones. And as we were talking about there, Dizzy will be on the road with Guns N' Roses. He's going to be in the UK for the Download Festival, which I'm desperately trying to get to because Blackstone Cherry are playing on the same night. And people who regularly listen to the podcast will know how much I love Blackstone Cherry. So the thought of seeing Guns N' Roses and Blackstone Cherry on the same night is just mind-blowing for me. But yeah, Donington Park on the Saturday night, Guns N' Roses. And it's like he says, don't be that guy. I'm hoping not to be that guy. I'm hoping to get there, certainly. And his solo album, Rock and Roll Ain't Easy, is out now on Golden Robot Records, and it's absolutely awesome. Other stuff relating to Dizzy. Interestingly, you know, he's picked his classic album there, Sticky Fingers, and it seems like it was a really hard choice for him. If you get yourself over to loudersound.com, he actually contributed to a really awesome article, The 10 Records That Changed My Life. And Sticky Fingers is on there, along with some other awesome albums. News of the World by Queen is an awesome shout. I hope someone does that album one day. So if you want to find some albums that maybe have inspired Rock and Roll Ain't Easy, and I know that Dizzy said that Sticky Fingers played a big part in that, get yourself to loudersound.com for the Dizzy Reed 10 Records That Changed My Life article. Definitely worth a read. Right, and so that's it for another episode of My Classic Album. Thanks very much for joining me, everyone. And yeah, there's some great episodes in the pipeline, so keep your eye on those social media pages. Keep an eye on the website, myclassicalbum.co.uk. And I'll be back very soon with another classic album. Thanks for listening. Cheers.